To answer is human. To question is divine. Welcome to the world of the Hidden Gateway, an exhilarating podcast exploring the concepts humans have been struggling with since the dawn of existence, such as, who are we? Is there such a thing as good and evil, or are they arbitrary constructs? Does the paranormal exist? How can we evolve to a higher state? Can our mind influence what we term as reality? Providing a transcendental approach combined with hard-nosed humanistic analysis, we invite you on a journey to question your worldview in this theater of life. Join our host, Justin Williams, as he explores the outer realms of faith, the supernatural, human potential, and even our concepts of the universal creator with a fascinating array of guests. This is the unseen world, magical, mysterious, and mystical, where your only limitation is your imagination. This is the Hidden Gateway.
Welcome back to another episode of the Hidden Gateway podcast. As always, I'm your host, Justin Williams. Today's guest is hailed as the philosopher-poet of the environmental movement. He is the author of 25 books, including The Myth of Human Supremacy, Endgame, and A Language Older Than Words. He holds a degree in creative writing from Eastern Washington University, a degree in mineral engineering physics from the Colorado School of Mines, and is taught at Eastern Washington University and Pelican Bay State Prison. He has packed university auditoriums, conferences, and bookstores across the nation, stirring them with revolutionary spirit. Derek Jensen, welcome to the Hidden Gateway podcast. How you doing, my friend?
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm doing okay. How you doing?
Oh, I'm good. Thank you. Thanks for asking. I appreciate that. And as I said before we hit record, thank you so much for taking time out your schedule to be with us here on the Hidden Gateway podcast. So, Derek, first question I have for you. I'm always interested to know how people got to where they are. So if you could take the time and give our audience a little background on you in regards to how you got into doing what you do, that'd be great.
Well, I guess we can start with, one of the issues I work on is men's violence against women and children. And, my father was extremely violent. He broke my sister's arm. My brother has epilepsy from blows to the head. He raped my mother, my sister, and me. And I obviously didn't ask this question. I wasn't this articulate as a child, but the question was hanging in the air was, if his behavior isn't making him happy, why is he doing it? And so that is one piece that I've been sort of exploring my whole life, is why do people do things? Why do people do destructive things that don't make them happy? Mm-hmm. And why do people do destructive things in general? Okay, so that's one part. The next part was when I was in second grade, they put in a subdivision right next to where I lived. And the meadows and fields turned into white box houses. And I remember thinking, okay, this is the language I did have as a second grader, so 7 years old or whatever, is where the cottonwood's going to go, where the meadowlark's going to go, where the grasshopper's going to go, the garter snakes. The language I didn't have at the time, but this is the idea that I understood then, is you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. And so that's the sort of second piece. That's pretty much when I became an environmentalist, is just recognizing this can't go on forever. And in many ways, that would sum up all of my work, is this way of life won't last. And when it's over, I would prefer there's more of the world left rather than less. Okay, so now let's fast forward again to when I was in college getting a degree in physics and physics engineering. And that just means physics with some extra engineering classes. And I wasn't having a very good time. And about at that same time, I had this habit of asking people if they liked their jobs. And about 90% would say no. And so that really made me think, it's like, what does it mean when the vast majority of the people spend the vast majority of their waking hours doing things they don't want to do? And that just seems like a crazy way to run a society, that we're all, it's like, I would ask my fellow students if they were enjoying college, and for the most part, they would say no. And I would say, are you looking forward to being a petroleum engineer? And they would say no, but when I get out of here, I'm going to buy myself a really nice car. And, I understand, the allure of that, but we only get one lifetime. And, it seemed strange to me to, to spend your lifetime doing things that you don't really want to do. And then the final piece I want to bring in right now is, so I what I really wanted to do with my life is I wanted to be a writer. I didn't really want to be an engineer. And I got the degree because, my mom gave me some of the best advice that I've ever gotten in my life. I wanted to quit school when I was a junior. And she said, would you rather go the rest of your life saying that you have a degree in physics, or would you rather go the rest of your life saying you have 3 years toward a degree in physics? And that was one of the reasons that I was able to be a writer and not make any money at all and be a terrible writer for quite a long time, because it takes a long time to learn how to write, is that I had that safety net, of a degree in engineering that I could have quit at any time, and my safety net was not getting a job at Walmart. My safety net was getting a decent paying job. And you can be really courageous when you've got a safety net. That helps a lot. So anyway, so I'm in my mid-20s, and I recognize that there are a lot of things wrong with the world, and I don't know how to do anything. I don't know how to fix them. The problems are so big, I'm so small, and I don't even know. And we can get into more of this later, but the point is that I made one of the smartest decisions I've ever made, which is I realized I wasn't paying enough for gas, by which I mean that at the time gas was 80 cents a gallon or something, and that didn't cover the ecological and social costs of it. So for every dollar I spent on gas, I was going to give a dollar to a local, not national, a local environmental organization, but I didn't have any money. So what I started doing is paying myself $5 an hour to do activism. Wow. And if I spend $10 on gas, that means this week I need to do 2 hours of activism. And I would, write a letter to the editor. And here's the difference is that, I was so scared I wouldn't even use my real name. And, now I've got books out with my name on them. And I did an anti-circus demo, and I just knew circuses are bad. I didn't know why. So I just showed up and they gave me a sign, and somebody said, why are circuses bad? And I said, I don't know, ask the guy next to me. and then I started doing, there was a military base near where I live. So I did some, military bad sort of things. And then I started doing some, they're called timber sale appeals. We can get into them if you want. But the point is that I started having so much fun with the activism that I stopped keeping track. But the point is that I got off my butt. That's the real point. And everything in my work is aimed at, no matter what it is that you love, it's under assault. And so, I don't care what your issue is. Find what your issue is and then commit an hour to a week to it, and just start and do something. Don't just, it's so easy to go, oh gosh, things are messed up and they're too big and I can't do anything. Just, a couple hours a week. And unless you are a single parent raising 4 children and also taking care of your dying parent, you can probably afford an hour or two a week.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right. And now let's go.
Just start small with something. I didn't start by going, okay, I'm going to, end up starting this organization and I'm going to end up writing all these books. It's like, oh, that's another thing. One last thing, sorry, is that I never, people ask me, so how do you write a book? And the answer is I don't. I write a page, and then I write another page, and I write another page. And there's a line, this is a total cliche, but my mother's grandmother used to say this to her, and then my mother used to say this to me, total cliche, inch by inch, life's a cinch, yard by yard, life's hard. And, you know, it's just, you know, I do it step by step. I mean, again, writing is just too intimidating. But I can do a page. I can certainly do a page.
Okay, say that one more time, what your mother and your grandmother used to tell you.
Inch by inch, life's a cinch. Yard by yard, life is hard.
Oh, okay. I like that. Very cool. Very cool. I like it a lot. Thank you. Thank you. So, Derek, let's go back to the question that you mentioned earlier. And I would like to know your thoughts on this via your experience and all your years of research, right? Why do people do things they do not enjoy? And I understand we could probably sit here for the next hour and strictly talk about that. So I guess your 10,000 foot view answer, if you would.
Well, it's a great question. I think that there are a you know, sort of near infinite number of answers. I think that it depends on what we're talking about. One reason that people do a lot of things that they don't want to do is because if they don't, they won't have a place to live and they won't be able to eat because we've been made dependent upon the very system that is, you know, it's interesting. This is a horrible story, but it's really fascinating to me that in the 1830s, there was a correspondence I read between a pro-slavery philosopher from Louisiana and his northern abolitionist buddy from some city in the north. And the pro-slavery philosopher was saying, look, we would release all of these enslaved peoples immediately. If he didn't say enslaved peoples, of course, he said slaves. We would release them all immediately if we could arrange the right land ownership conditions, because it is in the capitalist's best interest to own people under certain land ownership conditions. It's in their best interest to not own people and under others. And it's very simple. If there's a lot of land and not many people, that means people have access to land, which means they have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means they have access to self-sufficiency, which means the only way they're going to go to work for you is at the point of a gun. On the other hand, if you have a lot of people, like in a city, and not much land, then they don't have access to land, which means they don't have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means they don't have access to self-sufficiency, which means that they have to go to work for you for whatever pittance. And so he said, look, if you could arrange land ownership conditions here in the South, like you have up in Chicago or New York or whatever city it was, we would release them immediately because it's a better deal for us. Yeah. Talking about nothing about justice or fairness or anything like that. This is from a purely economic standpoint. So the point is that, you know, if you are dependent upon those who are exploiting you, then you will do anything to survive. And this is true whether we're talking about the individual level of the domestic violence. One of the things that perpetrators do is they immediately cut their victims off from their family, from their support system. They make them financially dependent upon them. One of the reasons that my mom stuck around is because I came a bit later, but she had three kids by the time she was 19 in the 1950s, whatever year it was, 1950s. And you try being a 19-year-old single mother in 1952 or whatever, from a religious family where you don't believe in divorce. And it's like, how are you going to support the kids? And so one reason we do a lot of things we don't necessarily want to do is because we're embedded in a system where that... Oh, one more thing about this is that the laws of apartheid of South Africa... Okay, yes, they're completely racist. I'm not saying they're not racist, but they weren't created specifically, oh, let's oppress the Africans. They were created because they had mines, M-I-N-E-S. They had gold mines and diamond mines, and they didn't have anybody to work in them. And the local people, the Africans, lived in subsistence villages. They didn't have a cash economy. They had cows. They had, you know, they would eat wildlife and they would grow, I don't know what they grew for vegetables. They grew whatever vegetables. They didn't have any need for a cash economy. So how do you get people to work in the mines? You can't pay them because nobody, I mean, they don't need money. So what they did is one of the first things is they put in place poll taxes, hut taxes, dog taxes. So they got to pay taxes. They got to pay taxes in cash. How do they get cash? Somebody's got to go to work. So the point is, how do they get you? Oh, one more story about this, which is I knew this woman a few years ago who had been married to a guy from Bangladesh and about my age. So he was in the 80s, he was in his 20s. And when he was a teenager in his 20s, his mother would say to him, you know, go get some lunch, and he would go down to the river and fish. And then 10 years later, the river was so polluted that there weren't any fish in it anymore, and they had to get their fish from Iceland, which means they got to pay for them. The lunch was, before that, he had not had to get a job in order to get lunch because he could just go fish. That's just an example of the entire story I've been telling here. Why do people do things they don't want to do? A lot of times it's because, and then, and you see why my books are nonlinear. And then after that, once we get past needing our basics, there's something that Lewis Mumford called the magnificent bribe, which is that we get addicted to, you know, I love the Doobie Brothers album title, What Once Were Vices Are Now Habits. And it's the same. What once were luxuries become necessities. If you don't mind me saying, how old are you?
I'm 44. I'll be 45 in a couple months.
Okay. So you don't okay. So when do you remember 40? So if you're 44, that means you were born in 1978.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you remember a childhood without the internet, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Okay. So the point is, and I mean, I grew up without computers, and then there was, I remember the first email I got was like 1991 or something, 30 years old or something. The point is that these days, when the internet goes out, I freak out as much as everybody else does. It's gone from something that nobody even had. Or a small example, my garage door opener broke a couple months ago. And I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, my job was to be the garage door opener. You know, when we came home from the grocery store, I decided mom said, "Get out."
Yeah.
And nowadays, everybody has a garage door opener. I mean, everybody who has a garage. And it's so my point is that it's not merely that we need the stuff for food, clothing, and shelter, but in addition, we get addicted to the consumer goods. And Lewis Mumford, and if you want, I can try to find it and read it, but Lewis Mumford has this fabulous bit about how have we surrendered ourselves to those in power. And it's basically what he calls a magnificent bribe, that you and I and everybody listening to this probably has more access to luxuries than any Roman emperor. And to any king 200 years ago, you know, they didn't have access to ice cream 24/7. They didn't have access to, I mean, they didn't have instantaneous communication. They couldn't get on a plane and fly and be across the country in, you know, 6 hours, 4 hours, whatever. They didn't have access to, they didn't have the ability to watch distant sports or, you know, whatever. They didn't have any of that. And what Mumford makes clear, and he wrote this in the early 60s, and things are even worse now, is that we give up on any vestiges of democracy as long as you keep giving us all this cheap plastic crap. And so the word I want to bring up here is the word addict, because one of the reasons, yes, we need food. I'm not dismissing that at all. But in addition, we become addicted to this way of life. We become addicted to the luxuries. And I love the word addict, because the word addict comes from the same root as the word edict, and it means to enslave. Because in ancient Rome, a judge would issue an edict enslaving, addicting one person to another. So that's how I become your slave, is, you know, I do something bad to you, and then the judge says to you, or the judge says to both of us, okay, Derek is now edicted. I mean, he issues an edict saying Derek is now addicted to you. I'm now enslaved to you. And that's how addiction works. I mean, I love the line. I think it's from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, of at first he drank from the bottle and then the bottle drank from him. And, you know, it's the same with the whole system that, and this goes back to my question of, you know, most people spending most of their waking hours doing things they don't want to do is, you know, the system, sure, we're getting ice cream 24/7, but the system is drinking from us.
Yes, it is. Absolutely. So it's almost, you know, everything you said, one thing that keeps coming to mind, it's the old saying, you know, the gift and the curse, but really, is it a gift? Are people maybe even tricked or fooled to think it's a gift, but maybe it's just 100% curse if the bottle is drinking from us, right?
Well, yes. And I think the thing that is, okay, a couple things. One is, years ago, I interviewed this guy back in the 90s. I interviewed this guy who had written a bunch of books about how this culture is really destroying the planet. And the interview was terrible because I didn't know this, but he had very recently written a book stepping away from everything he'd ever said. And the reason, and he said this explicitly, is the reason he realized this culture is really great is because he'd had open heart surgery and it saved his life. And that's fine. You know, I would be dead without modern medicine. And I'm not denying that. But the important thing is that you don't judge a society as a whole by how it benefits you.
Wow. Truth.
Because if you do, then obviously slaveholders in 1840 Mississippi, it's like, yeah, this is a great way to live. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, they're the winners. And that's not how you judge it. And what we have to acknowledge is that, I mean, this way of life is destroying the planet. It's based on systematically exploiting the poor. And so, yeah, we at the top, and I'm meaning almost everybody in the United States. I mean, because we're globally, you know, I don't know the numbers on this. I'm making up this number, but it's like half the people in the world don't, like, have never been taught how to read, or, you know, it's 40%, 20%. It's a significant number. And it's like the global extremely poor, you know, everybody in the United States, you know, 99.5% of everybody in the United States is wealthy compared to the sort of poorest of the poor. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that there aren't class stratifications in the United States. Of course, I'm not saying that. Right. What I'm saying is that we are, you know, greatly benefiting from this entire system that is systematically impoverishing the poorest. And that's not even to talk about what it's doing to non-humans and to the people who may live in the future and inherit this impoverished world. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we're getting a lot of goodies. You know, the one way I think about this is, like, how would we all feel if you live in a neighborhood and there's like five families in the neighborhood who have access to everybody's bank accounts and who just with impunity walk in and steal everything from everybody? It's like everybody else, I mean, they're doing great and they think the system works perfectly. And everybody else is like, yeah, it's not working quite so well for me.
Right. Interesting stuff. Now, I've heard you talk about the industrialized society, and it's your belief that, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's your belief that that needs to collapse. And if that's true in what I said, based off, you know, doing my research, my due diligence before this interview, I guess my question for you is, if the industrialized society collapses, won't that bring about the deaths of millions, if not billions of people?
Well, every cell in my, okay, I'll back up. And like I said earlier, this way of living can't last. It's really a one-time blowout. Any way of living that's based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. Mm-hmm. And you would think when we have an entire society that's based on, I don't know, let's choose a random example, oil, we would talk about what's going to happen when the oil runs out. It doesn't matter if it's going to run out, you know, it doesn't matter if it runs out slowly, quickly. It doesn't matter if it's going to run out in 5 years or 50 years. It will run out. Mm-hmm. And the same is true for renewable resources. That I live in salmon territory, and even as recently as the 1930s, okay, I'll back up a little bit, that prior to conquest, this county is really, it's really weird, this county, which is not very well, fairly highly populated now, there's maybe 30,000, 40,000 people in the county, this county had like 15,000 people in it, or 10 to 15,000 people in it before conquest, because there were so many salmon. So, you know, some places did not have a lot of people in them, and this place did. And the reason is because they could all eat salmon, and they would eat salmon and salmon and salmon, and then they'd eat more salmon. And as late as the 1930s, the Klamath River, which is the second largest river on the Pacific coast of the United States after the Columbia, the Klamath was so full of salmon that the river itself was called Black and Roiling. It's a big river. Within the last 5 years, the Indians who live along the river haven't had fish for their salmon festivals. It's just the populations are completely collapsing. And my point is that if you have uncountable salmon, and then you can count them, and then there's 5 million, and then 3 million, and then 1 million, and then 500,000, we see that that's trending down. And so at some point, so a lot of people aren't going to like this, but it's just true. So 30-some years ago, I was riding a car with my friend George Traffin, and we were stuck in traffic in Seattle. And I said to him, I'm just making conversation. I said, so George, if you could live at any level of technology that you wanted, what would it be? And he was not in a very good mood. And he said, that's a really stupid question, Derek. We can fantasize whatever we want, but the only level of technology that's sustainable is the Stone Age. And we'll be living there again someday. And the only question is what's left of the world when we get there. Hmm. My point is that these computers, the forced air furnace that's running right now, those aren't sustainable. They require an entire infrastructure. And every cell in my body wants for us to have a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living. But I don't believe it's going to happen. And the people who live 100 years from now they're not going to care about who won the World Series. They're not going to care that they have finally made the designated hitter rule universal, which I think is just a terrible philosophy. They're not going to care how hard we tried. They're not going to care if it was Democrats or Republicans in this White House. They're not going to care. What they're going to care about is whether the land can support them. Uh-huh. And they're going to care about whether they can drink the water in the river and whether they can breathe the air. And, you know, I'm going to go a slightly different direction for a second. And, okay, I don't want to get in. I don't want to get into big fights about COVID. I just want to mention one thing about it, which is I got really interested in it about a week after the news hit, because after they shut down Wuhan, 1 week later, a Hyundai factory in Korea shut down. And the thing I find fascinating and horrifying is that we have created an interdependent global economic system in which we are dependent, even for things like food, on places that are a long ways away that can be, and my point is not COVID, my point is not any of that. My point is that it's stupid to have a system that can be interdicted, a system on which you're dependent for things like food that can be interdicted by anything from an earthquake to a war to a disease. It doesn't matter. That so my point of all this is, yes, we will not be living this way forever. And if I were in charge, I would not deindustrialize overnight, which, you're right, would kill billions of people. If I were in, and which will happen someday, their population will be lower someday than it is now. And every cell in my body wants for that to be done in a way, you know, it would actually be pretty easy to lower the population without hurting anybody. And that's about half of the children who are born in the world right now are not actively planned. And so if you just give women absolute reproductive freedom and you give, and you just make it so the only children who are born are the ones who are really wanted, you know, that would slowly solve that problem. But the problem is that A, we're immediately running into the Abrahamic religions, you know, because like the Catholics are like, you know, birth control, and, you know, the Afghanistan is just a nightmare for women right now. And the other problem we're running into is the capitalist growth imperative. The capitalism has to grow every year. It's a Ponzi scheme. And this is one reason that when I get so frustrated when people say that it's racist to talk about overpopulation, because A, they're partly right, and B, they're partly wrong. And the place they're right, I'll talk about the place they're wrong first, is there are simply more humans than the planet can support. That's just true. The place they're right, though, is the way people talk about it. You know, they get all upset because there are a lot of babies in Mexico City or a lot of babies in Nairobi. But when the population starts to go down in Japan or Russia, they start freaking out because Japan's population is starting to decline, and the government is doing things like having sex holidays where people are supposed to go home and have sex so they can have babies. And my point is that we have, this takes us back to second grade, we have a way of life that's based on infinite growth, and that can't last. So if I was in charge, I would not actually deindustrialize immediately. I would start by cutting off things that are completely unnecessary, like, and this is just a stupid example, but retractable stadium roofs. I mean, we don't need that crap. You know, we don't need this level of luxury. We don't need, it's like people have said, gosh, Derek, you know, we all need to take shorter showers because the world's running out of water. And yes, 25% of the rivers in the world no longer reach the ocean, but it's not because people are taking showers. That's if you take shorter showers, it's going to mess with your social life. That's the same amount of water is used by municipal golf courses as is used by municipal humans. So start off by getting rid of some golf courses. And I hope you don't take this personally because you live in Arizona, but you don't need orange groves or rice paddies or alfalfa fields in Arizona.
Just no, I don't take that personally at all.
and so if I were in charge, I would start with, you know, taking off the stuff that is completely unnecessary. And then we'd start moving toward, you know, things that are more important to us. you know, one of the last things to go would, for me, would be the whole medical system, because that's saving people's lives. But early on, I mean, we don't need retractable stadium roofs. We don't need, you know, a lot of stuff. We actually don't need strawberries in January, or things that look like strawberries but actually taste like cardboard. And so my point is, that's not even the point. The point is that, like a doctor friend of mine says, the first step, let's see, correct diagnosis is the first step toward proper treatment. And if we don't acknowledge that you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet, then there's nothing we can do. So really, that's all I'm doing is saying, look, let's talk about this and figure out what we're going to do about this terrible, terrible situation. Right. And no, that doesn't mean I want to kill 7 billion people.
It sounds like you're saying it's simply just that there has to be some sacrifices made in order for humanity to be in a positive place or state 100 years from now, 200 years from now. Is that
I think there have to be some sacrifices made for humanity to continue to exist 100 years from now.
To exist. That's better yet. Okay. Now, you kind of surprised me when you said, you know, hey, take away the medical, you know. Obviously, I know your reasoning behind it, but what are people to do, you know, when you do something like that, right? I know you don't want to get off into the whole COVID thing, but you know, there are people that are pro-vax. I'm not one of them. You know, no, for the record, I've not been vaccinated and will not be vaccinated. How does even something like that play into it?
I think that this is really weird, since a lot of my positions are pretty radical, but honestly, I came to all of this stuff by being fundamentally conservative, by which I don't mean, you know, sort of socially conservative. I don't mean what we mean by, I don't even know what conservative means at this point, but here's what I mean by it. That, I mean, because liberal and conservative have gotten so weird the last 10 years, but leaving all that aside, just forget I said all that, I just think it's really stupid to kill salmon when you might need to eat them tomorrow. I think it's really stupid to foreclose one's options for luxuries today, foreclose one's future options. I think, and so, If I were, again, magically put in charge, I would not get rid of antibiotics. But one thing I would do is I would not use antibiotics on factory farms. I wouldn't have factory farms at all. But, you know, they talk about the, you know, and what I would do is I would attempt to approach things as reasonably as possible and recognize, for example, that we are people for about 100 years who have access to antibiotics, and that won't last. That, you know, already the bacteria have been fighting back for the last, you know, 30, 40 years, especially, and developing antibiotic resistance. So what I mean by all this is okay, again, the supplies of energy that we have are not infinite, and they won't last forever into the future. So I would just ask whether, given that the amount of energy that we will have this way is finite. Okay, it's like, I think it's really stupid. I can't believe, you know, all these, a lot of the people, you know, when I hear about some of the stuff that is built in the Arabian OPEC countries, it blows me away, because they're building indoor ski resorts and stuff like that. And if I was in charge over there, I would be preparing my infrastructure for the end of oil by making sure that when oil's gone, or when they no longer have, you know, it's like, I don't remember the numbers, but it's something like 50% of NFL players go bankrupt within 5 years of the end of their career.
Oh, yeah.
And there have been studies done on winners of lotteries. And it's like, I don't remember the numbers, but you're nodding, so I presume you've seen these too, where it's like 70% of them go bankrupt within X number of years or something. And it's like, if you get a blowout like that, which we have with oil, that's a one-time blowout. If you have it, you don't, you know, go buy drinks on the house for everybody every night at every nightclub in town. You know, buy your mom a house, and then you buy yourself a house, and then you recognize you're only going to be in the NFL 5 years. And it's the same with this, that I just wish that we would. Is what I'm saying making sense?
Yeah, I follow you. Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. So really, in many ways, that's. And so far as civilization collapsing, it's like all I think about. Another story on this is when I was a kid, I was very messy. I'm still, frankly, pretty messy. And when my mom would say to me, clean your room. And I would say yes, and then I wouldn't do it. And then she would say, clean your room, and this would go on for a little while. And then she would finally say, okay, so you are going to clean your room by dinner time. And if you don't, I'm going to clean your room. And if I clean your room, you're not going to like it because I'm going to throw everything away. And I would then clean my room. And the point here is we're facing the same thing on a larger scale with nature, that either we can start approaching these problems, we can try to clean up some of our messes, and we can try to start approaching things a bit more reasonably. If we don't, nature's going to do it. And if nature does it, we're not going to like it because it's going to throw everything away.
Yeah.
That's really what I'm getting at. So it and your question's great. It's not this, but I do... I get annoyed, and you didn't do this. Again, I'm not saying anything about you, but I have had people write me like screaming notes going, God, you hate people. You want to kill 7 billion people, whatever. And it's like, I'm simply saying that this addiction can't go on. And it would be nice if we started doing something about the addiction. And if we don't, it's going to end badly. And it's already going badly for the salmon. It's going badly for the North Atlantic right whales. It's going badly for non-humans already and for very, very, very poor humans. I asked Anuradha Mittal years ago, she's former director of Food First, if the people of India would be better off if the global economy disappeared tomorrow. And she laughed and said, of course. And there are former granaries of India that now export dog food and tulips to Europe. And there are people who are forced off their land. Farmers, subsistence farmers have been forced off their land by Coca-Cola for the water. And that's... So those... You know, you, me, and the rest of everybody listening to this are completely dependent upon the electrical grid. But there's something like 40% of the people on the planet don't have access to industrial electricity. And when the grid goes down, they're not going to suffer at all because they still have. Right. This takes us back to the COVID thing. They still have the local food economies. Mm-hmm. So, again, that's another thing I would do, as well as getting rid of retractable stadium roofs and golf courses, is I would work really hard to relocalize food systems. So when the grid does really start to collapse, you don't starve, but instead – you have something of a local food system. And I don't know what everybody in Arizona is going to do. And that's part of the problem, too, is that there are more of us than the planet can support. And there are more of us, especially living these industrial lifestyles, than the planet can support. And the thing, again, you didn't do this. I'm really enjoying the conversation with you. But people have gotten really mad at me about this. And it's like, that's like getting mad at the doctor who's telling you you've got cancer. It's like, I'm just doing analysis. I'm not actually going to take away your retractable stadium roof or your you know, or your, I'm not going to touch your Wi-Fi. I'm just saying that the Wi-Fi is not going to last forever.
Got it. Interesting. I definitely appreciate your point regarding the food there. That's excellent. But Derek, is it all bad? I guess some would say that these 15-minute cities, right, that have been in the news lately, and
I don't know what that is.
So there are these cities that are being planned. I think they're in the midst of building one somewhere in Europe, maybe the UK, where essentially everything anyone would ever need is within 15 minutes of their home, right? They claim that they will be great for the environment, with the aim to make cities more livable and connected, with less private car use, which would mean cleaner air, greener streets, and a lower levels of planet heating pollution. And then I saw something as well regarding the UN deal or treaty that is supposed to protect the high seas and marine life. I mean, that sounds like a good positive thing. And obviously the work that you do with your organization, which I would love for you to, you know, tell me about, specifically the Deep Green Resistance. I definitely want to hear about that.
Well, so far as the cities, I mean, that's great if people make a city where you can walk to the grocery store. But it doesn't alter the fact that from the beginning, cities have required a countryside from which they steal. And like, where do you get the bricks for your city? Where do you get the wood? Where do you get the water? Where do you get the food? In a couple books ago, I did with Max Wolbert and Lear Keith, called Bright Green Lies, we have a chapter devoted to cities. And in there, we talk about how there are studies done that if you basically converted every single bit of land in Seattle, medians on highways, lawns, everything, to food production, the population would still only be like, it could only do like 15% of the population or something. You still need to import food. And they've always been sinks that steal from the countryside or that take from the countryside. And then where does your poop go? It's pretty funny. I swear way too much, honestly. And in Bright Green Lies, we had some swear words, and the publisher said, "Let's take them. We need to take them out because we don't want to offend anybody." And at one point, there was a mistake with the editor that we fixed before it went to print, but we were asking about New York City. And can I swear on the show, or is that not okay?
That's fine. Absolutely. Yeah. Be your authentic self, please.
Okay. Well, I don't need to swear here. Well, I need to swear right here. We asked the question, where does the shit go from New York City? And they changed the word shit to stuff. And I'm like, that doesn't really make sense, because we're actually talking about poop. Where does the poop go from New York City? When you have 8 million people or however many people living in that area, it's got to go somewhere. And it's interestingly enough, it used to be dumped in the ocean, but it was creating such a mess out there. Now they take it all by train to this one county in Alabama and dump it. And the people in that county can no longer sit on their porches because the smell is so bad. Anyway, so when you have a city, that's nice that you can walk. It's nice you can do all that. But the stuff has to come from somewhere, and the waste products have to go somewhere, and you just can't have, it's still not sustainable. And are there good things? I mean, sure. You know, it's really interesting. You know, I think a lot of people would say that Richard Nixon is probably the most hated president of the 20th century. He's pretty close in the United States, but interestingly, and he was actually quite conservative, but he was like the best environmental president of the 20th century. He signed the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, NEPA, NFMA, the Endangered Species Act. All that stuff was through on his watch. And so even when things are bad, you can still get some good things happening. And so, yeah, the ocean sanctuaries, a lot of that stuff's pretty good. And there is... the problem is that on the largest scale, you know, everything's going the wrong direction. but there are a lot of sites of there are a lot of people who are resisting in ways that are important. And there is, so here's a great example, is that, and this is not so much resistance, but just a good thing. They're going to take out 5 dams on the Klamath River. It's legally, I mean, it's all gone through the governments, the tribal governments, the federal government, Oregon and California. And they're going to take them out within the next couple of years. And that's great. The problem is that there are 2 million dams in the United States over 6.5 feet tall. And 70,000 dams over 6.5 feet tall, 60,000 dams over 13 feet tall. The 2 million dams includes itty bitty tiny little dams. But anyway, there's 60,000 dams over 13 feet tall in the United States alone. And so we're taking out 5, and that's great, but we need to do a lot more. And it's the same with a lot of this other, a lot of the other good things that are happening. It's just, it's this sort of tidal wave of destruction. And it's great that there are some good things. I don't mean to be, see, part of the thing is, and you know, sometimes people go, gosh, Derek, you're so morose about this. It's like, actually, no, I'm pretty happy. I'm actually quite a happy person. It's just that we're in a bad situation. And it's like, you know, a doctor told my mom she had pancreatic cancer, and and she died 6 months later. And, you know, he gave her bad news, but that didn't make him a bad person. I mean, actually, the doctor was, my mom loved that doctor, and I love that doctor. He's great. It's just in that moment he had to deliver bad news. And, I think again, if we don't look at the situation, then we won't know what to do. We spend more energy trying to avoid looking at how bad things are than we would if we just said, oh yeah, things are really bad. Okay, so let's roll up our sleeves. What are we going to do? And anyway, you mentioned DGR. So Deep Green Resistance is an organization that we founded, I don't know, 15 years ago. And it is an organization that, it sort of acts as an umbrella in that a lot of people will do a lot of different work. It's based on the understanding that civilization can never be sustainable and that it's destroying the natural world. But then, having acknowledged that, you know, a lot of people work within the system to try to, like right now, there are people at Thacker Pass in Nevada attempting to stop a lithium mine, and they've been using lawsuits, and they've been working with local ranchers and also the local Indian nations, and they have been working with all these different groups. And the difference between us and a lot of other groups is simply that, yes, we will do all this stuff. At the same time, we're still acknowledging, you know, that stopping this mine by itself is not sufficient. And so, and we've got people all over the world. There's a big group in France, big group in London, big group in the Philippines. And we've got some groups, I believe, in Kenya. And what they'll do is they'll work on local issues, and then they will connect. They don't necessarily work on issues away from where they live, but they connect it to the larger global struggle to protect the planet from this culture.
I see. And thank you for bringing that up regarding that lithium mine. You said it's in Nevada, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I read something not too long ago regarding the DGR and standing, or, well, what was the whole, without me knowing how to exactly word it, but the whole issue that was going on regarding the transgenderism. issue. Can you just touch on that briefly?
Sure. That's another position we take, is that we believe that women, including those who have been sexually abused by men, should not be forced to share their most vulnerable spaces with men. So, for example, there are women in prison in California who are being forced to, and other states too, who are being forced to share their cells with males because the males say that they are women. And that there are women who have been raped already in prison because of this. And we think that that is a human rights violation and an atrocity. And likewise, we don't think that men should be allowed into women's sports. We think that women's sports... I was a high jumper in college, and I was good enough that I won my small college conference championship, broke my school record. Nice. But I wasn't good enough to win NCAA Division II, to go to NCAA Division II even, and certainly not to go to NCAA Division I. But the point is, again, I was good enough to win my conference championship for a small school, but had I identified as a woman, I would have held the world record. And it's just absurd. I mean, you know all the stuff about how there are boys' high school soccer teams that can beat the women's national team. And
right.
It's just... And I want to go on about this a little bit more, that we sometimes, a lot of the, many of the people who are the strongest opponents of the whole transgender movement are lesbians and gays, because there are lesbians who are accused of bigotry because they don't want to have sex with men who identify as women. And so what we believe, I'll just be clear about this, because there are a lot of lies have been told about us. What we believe is that a little boy who loves to dance and who loves to play with dolls should be loved precisely for who he is, which is a little boy who loves to dance and play with dolls. And a little girl who loves to play football and work on cars should be loved for being a little girl who loves to play football and work on cars. That doesn't mean she's a little boy. And sex is immutable. We are, every human who's ever been born is a result of a male sperm and a female egg. And humans are a sexually dimorphic species. But that doesn't mean that a woman should not be a doctor. I mean, you can be anything you want. You can have any vocation you want. You can have any hobbies you want. But that doesn't alter your physical reality. You know, I can wish that I didn't have Crohn's disease, or I can wish that instead of a high jumper, I would have been a shot putter, but I couldn't even lift up a shot put with one hand, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like I had really strong legs and really weak upper body strength. So it's like, that's the hand you're dealt. And so, you know, it's extraordinary to me. It's absolutely extraordinary to me that I've been talking about bringing down civilization for 20 years. Nobody cares. I can attack corporations. I can talk about how we need to have a revolution. I can talk about because those in power take better care of corporations than they do human beings. I can talk about the prison industrial system. I can have, you know, all these opinions. Nobody cares. And the thing I get canceled for is for saying that male and female are physical states. It's insane. It's
that's sad. Insane. Yeah. Because it doesn't fit the narrative, right? It doesn't go along with the narrative.
Well, and there's a larger issue here too, which is that part of the problem is that we are so divorced from our bodies and from reality that we think that what we think is more important than what is real. And this is true. Like, I remember 15 years ago, I was watching some news show, Keith Olbermann, actually. And he was interviewing an astronomer, and he asked, so why do we need to explore Mars? And the interviewer said, we need to explore Mars to answer that most important question of all, which is, are we all alone? It was like, dude, look around. There are so many. I mean, we're surrounded by bald eagles and redwood trees and Kootenai sturgeon and Pacific tree frogs. And we're surrounded by all this wonderful life. And you think we're all alone. And likewise, when people talk about great pieces of art, the great pieces of art that they count are the Sistine Chapel, the Mona Lisa, et cetera, et cetera. They don't talk about birdsong. They don't talk about sunsets, or they don't even talk about the beauty of a body. That doesn't count. That's not art. And likewise, inventions. You know, what are the greatest inventions of all time? The screw, the lever, the gunpowder, you know, I don't know what. And no, what about metabolism? What about vision? What about sex? I would rather have sex than gunpowder. And but we don't count those as inventions because nature created them.
Yeah.
And so the point is we disrespect, we have contempt for everything that is real, and what we value is the stuff that we create. So no wonder we start to think that no, male and female aren't real things. Instead, what I think is more important than what's real. But it's just crap because, you know, Weyerhaeuser calls itself the tree growing company, but it doesn't mean it's a tree growing company. It's, you know, we understand. I mean, I don't know about you, but I have never once in my life actually been a jerk. The truth is, every time I've been a jerk, I've had it fully rationalized. You know, we can talk ourselves into anything is my point. And I don't actually care about what we talk ourselves into. What I care about is what's real.
Love it.
You know, I can tell you right now that I am a fabulous plumber. Don't know anything about plumbing. You know, I can tell you anything I want. That doesn't make it true. Mm-hmm. What's real is what's real. And that's what's that. And this is the thing that's been covering the entire conversation, is that I'm always most interested in what is real. And then we can build up from there. We can try to figure out from there what we think about what is real. But, you know, we need to start with what's real. Does that make sense?
I get it. I love it too, man. I love it. That's excellent. It's all about what is real. I mean, I couldn't agree more. That's very cool. That's very cool. One of the last questions I have here for you, Derek, I think you started to touch on it a little bit earlier. You know, when we talk about, you know, Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative, et cetera, I'm curious to know which one you think is worse, left or right, in terms of your views on the environment and societal change.
Well, it depends. It depends. Do you want to support the oil industry or the wind and solar industry? Because they just they represent, in terms of environment, they represent two different sectors of capitalism.
Okay.
Neither one's really representing the grizzly bears. You know, I think a lot about this a lot, basically in terms of good cop, bad cop. That the Republicans are basically the bad cop. They're going to come in and beat the crap out of you. And then the Democrats come in and it's like, you know, Bill Clinton actually said about NAFTA, I feel your pain. You know, it's like, so the Republicans, bam, 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 bam. Democrats, sorry, bud, this is the way it's got to be. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, come on, help me help you. You got to, but it's all good cop, bad cop. And they all just represent corporations. And then the whole liberal conservative thing. I mean, this is a whole another discussion. You know, I don't know. You know, your perspectives on different issues, but the whole thing sort of falls apart for me because, you know, on some issues, I would be probably classified as extremely liberal, lefty, whatever. And on some issues, I would probably classify as extremely conservative. It's like, this is, I'll tell you one thing that I used to read reviews of my work a long time ago, and I don't anymore. It's depressing. But one person said something I really liked, which is, at some point in his career, everybody is going to hate Derek Jensen because he refuses to adhere to any ideology, and he just takes his thinking wherever it goes. And I love that. You know, it's like, so I can, on some issues, you know, I'm way, way, way over here. And on some issues, I'm probably way over here. It's, I mean, I'll tell you one. It's like, okay, I think that the whole judicial penal system is really messed up profoundly in many ways. But I also think that there are some things that people can do that can cause them to forfeit the right to live. So I actually don't, and this horrifies some of my sort of lefty friends. It's like, if it weren't racist and classist, I wouldn't have a problem with the death penalty. It's like, I think Tony Hayward, the guy who was in charge of British Petroleum when the Deepwater Horizon went down, mm-hmm. He shouldn't be shot. He should have been tried and mm-hmm. if found guilty of the killing of the people on the thing. I think that can I tell you a satire piece I wrote a few years ago having to do with this subject?
Of course you can. Absolutely.
So I wrote this essay. I called it A Modest Proposal. You know, Jonathan Swift famously had his Modest Proposal, which was all satire about eating children in Ireland. It's all satire. So I'm saying up front it's satire. So I don't believe in technological solutions to a lot of the problems we face, but I do have one, which is remote-controlled cigar cutters. And I believe that when they put in the Deepwater Horizon oil rig, they said it wouldn't leak, it wouldn't have any problems. That's all fine. You can believe them, except every male associated with the project has to have a remote-controlled cigar cutter attached to his genitals. And if what they say is true and, you know, nothing bad happens, that's all fine. But if it's not, I mean, if what they said was a lie, then and we could do the same thing for politicians, you know, like they come into office and they say, I'm going to do this and this and this. And of course, we all know they're lying. But then you find out that they were, in fact, lying. And what that would do is that would give them some incentive to actually tell the truth. And again, this is satire.
That would definitely give them incentive to tell the truth. No doubt about it. Good stuff.
The left and right thing. It's also really weird because 20 years ago, I would never. Okay, it's very interesting. I wrote my book, Culture Make Believe, and I wrote that in 2002 or 3 or something. And in there, one of the things I talked about is how as economies collapse, the right goes increasingly insane. And I talk about how racism increases. And I go through various depressions in U.S. history and how racism would increase during the depression. And it has to do with competition in the workforce that, you know, if things are going fine, you know, everything is fine. But as jobs get more scarce, you start getting more and more upset and you'll take any advantage you can. And if I'm going to get a better job than you because here's the real point is instead of blaming those in power, we blame other people who are competing with us for the jobs.
Okay.
I'm going to blame the Irish. I'm going to blame the Romanians. I'm going to blame the black people. I'm going to blame those Mexicans coming across the border. I'll blame any of them except the capitalists. Mm-hmm. And so as an economy collapses or as it goes through a depression, racism increases. And I got that right. I'm so proud of myself for that. The right goes crazy. What I didn't get at all, what I completely swung and missed on, was as economies go through difficult times, the left goes crazy too. And it's really funny. My book, Culture Make Believe, won some awards for basically talking about how the right goes crazy and we become more racist when there's an economic depression. And so to correct my mistake in 2012 to 2014 or so, I wrote a book about how the left goes crazy. And that book cost me my publishers and basically got me blacklisted and has still never been published. And that is how the left goes crazy.
Wow.
The right goes crazy with all of this, with increased racism, you know, the stuff that you probably, you know, it's like you're aware of. I mean, we're all aware of how the right goes crazy. And the one of the ways I would never, obviously didn't predict 20 years ago that threats to free speech would come primarily from the left these days.
Well, how about that? I know all about that.
20 years ago. And yeah. It absolutely blows me away. And it's crazy. It's crazy. Okay, I know that as people get older, they generally, you know, get more conservative. That's not happening with me, but I know so many old school lefties who now say, I'm politically homeless. I can't. The Democratic Party is so completely insane.
Yeah.
And they'll say, I mean, I've actually, okay. Yeah. It's like old school lefties are just like myself are just flummoxed at how crazy things have gotten on the left.
It's a different game out there.
What?
So it's a different game out there, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
It really is. It really is. Derek, this has been great, my friend. You are a wealth of, you're a wealth of information, wealth of knowledge, that's for sure. You know, my final question for you is something I ask each and every guest that appears on the Hidden Gateway podcast. And what I would like for you to do is leave our listeners with what I like to call a token of love, something that you think that they need to hear in this moment today as they continue along with their journey.
Well, I think it's remarkably important to a couple things. One is it's remarkably important to find what it is you love and to defend what you love. And if what you love is, you know, women's spaces, defend that. If what you love is, you know, African-American youth, defend that. If what you love is long-form thinking, defend that. If what you love is independent bookstores, defend that. If, you know, it's if what you love is open and free discourse, defend that. You know, take the opportunity whenever you can to step up. I remember reading this thing about the second voice, that they did an experiment where a bunch of people were in a waiting room, but that was the experiment. They didn't, the subjects didn't know that was the experiment, was in the waiting room. So they're all waiting. And then one person in the room would say something really offensive. And what they found was most important to the other people's response was the actor would say something offensive, and then another person would respond to it, and how the second person responded affected how everybody else responded. If the second person said, oh my gosh, that joke is not very funny, that's, you shouldn't be saying those things about Polish Americans, then other people would be more likely to not laugh at it. If person number two loudly laughed at it, that gave permission to everybody else to laugh. And so it's that second voice that is so important. or another way to say this is something I read in a thriller novel that really hit me, which is the first person through the door always gets shot. So, so what I want for people to do is, you don't have to be the first person, because that can be scary, but be the second person through the door. You know, if you see somebody saying something courageous, say, good on you. And you don't have to be the person who says the courageous thing. That can be really scary, but at least say good on you. And then the other thing is that I really, you know, people will say to me, Derek, you've written all these books. Instead, you should be an organizer. You should stop doing this and do something else. It's like, I can't even organize my pens, you know? I don't, I'm just, so not only find what you love in terms of, you know, defending something, but also find what you really love doing and find what your gifts are and explore them. And what are the largest, most pressing problems that you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you and all the universe? And you, for example, I mean, and honestly, I don't mean this in a bad way. I didn't, until you wrote to me, I didn't know you. So I still don't know who you are, but you are doing something that I dearly love, which is we had an hour long interview, and long form thinking, I think, is desperately important. And your questions are great. You are participating and you are protecting and you are promoting long form thinking. And for that, I am profoundly grateful to you. And so I want for people to, and you're very good at it. That's my real point, is that I want for people to, you know, you, again, I don't know you, but you clearly found a hole in discourse and you filled it. And you also are good at it. So I want people to find something that's wrong and fix it. And I also want them to find what they are really good at and do that.
Love it. Thank you. And thank you so much for the kind words. I take that to heart and greatly, greatly appreciate it. Much gratitude for that, Derek. Thank you so much. Would you please take a moment to tell the good people where they can find you, website, if you have any social media, et cetera, where they can buy your books?
Books are available at bookstores and libraries, and also on my website. My website is Derek, DerrickJensen, DerrickJensen.org. And I've got a ton of essays up on there, and so they can find stuff to keep them occupied for a little while.
There it is. Very good. And thank you once again, Derek, for being a guest here on the Hidden Gateway podcast. Much gratitude to you, my friend. And you totally embodied one thing that we really take to heart here on the Hidden Gateway, and that is standing in your truth. So thank you for doing that. Thank you for all you do for humanity, and many, many more blessings to you, my friend. And to our audience, we really hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hidden Gateway podcast. As always, stay connected with us at thehiddengateway.com. Shoot us email, like a lot of you do, at support@thehiddengateway.com. And as always, thank you for pushing your mindset towards a better reality. Now, this will conclude this week's episode. Until next time, stay positive, stay questioning. Be love and be free. The Hidden Gateway, out.